Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Because it's May Day and you want to know what to protest or which protests to avoid. Welcome to Friday. I'm Bill Radke. We're taking 1 hour to recap this week's events and understand what they meant. And to help us do that, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. Hi, Eli.
Hi, Bill.
Seattle-based journalist Tanya Mosley, contributor to Al Jazeera America, contributor to KUOW and more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
A former Washington State Republican Party chair, Chris Vance. Good to see you, Chris.
Good morning.
This morning, Baltimore's top prosecutor surprised us, I think. Is that fair to say? At least in its speed, by announcing criminal charges against all six officers suspended following the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. State's attorney Marilyn Mosby said Gray's death from an unexplained spinal injury was a homicide. His arrest was illegal in the first place, and his treatment in custody amounted to murder and manslaughter. These charges come after days of violent, sometimes violent protests in Baltimore. And in downtown Seattle, 50 people blocked traffic in solidarity. Demonstrator Gina Petrie said riots are not an act of violence, but a response to violence.
People are losing their lives, and so we have to get people's attention to that this is a problem that we need to stand together to fix.
NPR spoke to a Baltimore resident about protesters smashing and looting Korean-owned grocery stores in mostly African-American neighborhoods.
It's almost like payback, I guess you could say.
Travis Fonseca is a tall, muscular 24-year-old hanging out on the corner. He says the looters were justified.
You know what I mean? For all of the unspoken things that has happened between those businesses and our people, I feel like it was payback. I don't feel like it was the most reasonable thing to do, but it's definitely justified.
I think most or all of us hope there's no property crime in Seattle today, but is it ever justified? Eli, you think it could be justified under certain circumstances?
Is that what you took from, I guess?
We exchanged an email about this.
Well, I think if you look at human history, if you look at the history of civilization, I think all of us would say there are circumstances where violence is justified to change the situation in a society. That the United States of America comes out of a violent revolution. And so those are the circumstances that I'm talking about, when things get so extreme that there's no recourse but to violence. There are a lot of other shades of possibility. And, you know, I think what you're hearing from the person who just spoke about Baltimore is frustration that has no good vent. And sometimes when people live in a condition like that for a very long time, it's hard to predict which way the frustration is going to vent. And it can sometimes go in directions that are shocking to us, but maybe shouldn't be because of the conditions that we turn our eyes away from.
Shouldn't be shocking, shouldn't be surprising maybe, but do you even think in terms of justifiable or not justifiable?
Well, it's a very tricky thing. For me personally, this is not the direction that I would go, but I've lived a different life than someone in Baltimore, say. So for me, I use words. I get paid for it. That's my way of having a voice in the world and trying to create some change that I think is important. For other people, they make different choices. I was talking about this yesterday with Mike McGinn, actually, who sees himself as an activist. And he said something similar. This is not my path. It's not something that I would do. But there are people who say we have to do this in order to get attention, or we do this because we don't know what else to do.
Chris Vance, is it okay to not really come down on whether violence or property destruction is justifiable or not justifiable? That's somebody else's motivation.
It's never justifiable. And this discussion is frankly absurd. I understand the conditions in Baltimore. I understand people who live in extreme poverty with no hope of getting out. And a lot of this is because of global competition and the loss of our industrial base. And I understand all that. But the law is the law and needs to be enforced, period. Or people lose respect for government.
What happens when you're sure the law is being enforced selectively and unfairly?
Well,
or that maybe the law is unfair?
There's no question but that when you're smashing store windows and stealing things for the fun of it, that the law is being broken. And this is also, It's an absurd discussion.
So it matters whether it's for the fun of it or not.
Or for economic gain or just pure frustration. But the reason this discussion is absurd is because it's the rest of society it doesn't question this. I mean, it's something that we can have an interesting conversation in sort of an intellectual format. But look what happened in Baltimore. Immediately, the next day, the National Guard was called in. Immediately, law-abiding citizens of those communities spoke out against this. The people who actually have something at stake don't tolerate this. Same thing happened here with WTO. For one unfortunate day, the mayor of Seattle and the Seattle police sort of tolerated the protesters. And the next day, the National Guard was on the streets. Because the broader society and those who live in those communities, they don't have, because they actually have something at stake. They don't have this sort of, silly discussion about whether it's okay to smash things and hurt people.
Tanya Mosley, is it silly and absurd to talk about justifiable rioting?
I don't think it's silly and absurd, but at the same time, I will say, and I agree with Eli, when you come from a certain circumstance, while I don't agree with it, I wholeheartedly understand it. And really, I am never angry when I see the destruction of property, quite frankly, because I see the bigger issue at play there. I see that when we're talking about Baltimore, for instance, there's so many systematic issues at play within Baltimore. And then you're talking about the death of Freddie Gray, and people are at a boiling point there in the city of Baltimore and in other places throughout the country. So really, I see that as, okay, that's secondary, that there was property that was damaged. But overall, my focus is not on the property damage. I'm not angry about that. Really, I am angry at the focus in the media on the property damage versus the issues. You know, they say that rioting is the voice of the unheard, and that's what it is. You have those people, those disenfranchised people who are out there, and they have no other voice. And so they're out there, and they are destroying things, and they're screaming, and they're fighting. And that's because they don't have a voice in mainstream society.
Well, I'd like to know what more voice they need to have in mainstream society when the mayor of Baltimore is black. The police chief is black. The government of Maryland is mostly run by liberal Democrats. I don't understand what more voice they need to have in their community.
Baltimore has some of the worst public school systems in the entire nation. It is a poor city. There are lots of systematic issues at play there, and it's beyond black and white just because there's a black woman who is at the head there. I mean, we're talking about more than just skin color here.
Right.
And it has a police force, as we heard from the prosecutor today in Baltimore, that apparently, allegedly, multiple police officers are behaving in ways that are awful. I mean, I don't know what other word to use for it. You're talking about the rule of law. The police are apparently behaving, according to prosecutors there, beyond the rule of law. And do you think that's an isolated experience? I don't know. I'm willing to believe at this point that it's not. And so imagine living in that situation your whole life.
And I understand the economy has not been good to Baltimore. And that's what I talked about earlier. And that, to me, is the real issue here.
Do you think racism is a part of it at all?
I'm certain it is on the streets. But to say they don't have a voice in a democracy, they can elect different people and get different outcomes. I understand things aren't going well there, but to say that institutionally they don't have a voice, as if our system doesn't work, is just wrong.
Well, let's talk about what the Republican Party, which you represent,
and
does.
It doesn't elect anybody in Baltimore.
Well, let's talk about what the Republican Party opposes in terms of access to the ballot. There are a lot of impoverished people in Baltimore who are working jobs that don't allow them to show up on election day and vote. They can't get time off because they can't afford it. There have been all kinds of pushes for more access to voting, for a voting holiday, say. Republicans oppose that. And you're talking about democracy as if it's this, like, completely functional apparatus all the time, equal in access for everyone. We know that's not true. Our history tells us that's not true, and our present tells us that's not true.
But the facts on the ground are that democracy seems to be working in Baltimore.
I don't think it's working
when the majority is electing people
behaving
who look
in
like
the way that the Baltimore Police Department allegedly behaved. How can you say that that's a good outcome?
All I'm reacting to is the idea that there is no way out of this. There is no voice for them. That's just not true.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. And, you know, my father was a lawyer. I believe in the law. I believe in the rule of law. I don't want to live in a society without respect for the rule of law. I really am uncomfortable by talking about May Day, by the anarchist proposition that's floated on May Day, because I don't like the idea of the absence of the rule of law. I think that's what people in Baltimore feel like they're experiencing, and they're rejecting an absence of evenly applied law. For me, or for any, you know, I'm a sexual minority in this country. The rule of law has been good to me over the last 10 years in terms of expanding my rights. There are all kinds of other minorities in this country that need the law to protect them. So I'm not sitting here rejecting the rule of law. What I'm saying is that sometimes when people live an experience of disenfranchisement and feel that they have no way out, even if you say they could just show up and vote more, I guess that's what you're saying. But if they still experience that, there is going to be, at a certain point, some vent for their frustration.
And I find it interesting that even in our coverage of May Day, we're talking about the destruction of property, traffic, backups. I have only seen in certain publications and in certain mediums talking about what May Day is actually about and what those people are actually out there protesting for. And so we're talking about anarchists, we're talking about the destruction of property, and we're talking about backups and how you need to leave at 2 o'clock from your jobs. Really, does the mainstream, do folks actually know what's going on out there? Our focus is on this and not on what the issue is.
Historically, May Day was a workers' rights day, and it changes. It's also a day to talk about immigrant rights. But, you know, when we're talking about protest, I have to say, on behalf of the anarchists, it's about whatever you want it to be about. You know, you don't have to have rules about what you're angry about on a Friday in Seattle.
Something that you were saying triggered something that I've been thinking about May Day just in Seattle. It is primarily, in terms of feet in the streets, about immigrant rights. When you look over the last few years, those are the majority of people that are out there, and they have an important issue to talk about. And by the way, they are talking about a remedy under the law. They want expanded rights for immigrants in the United States. And that is that's a legal solution. That's a political solution. And I think it's incredibly important, and it's incredibly sad when the focus becomes just like laser focused on anarchists and what they're going to do or what they're not going to do.
And anarchists are not a homogenous population of people, too. So there are anarchists who are out there for several different reasons. There are anarchists who are out there destroying property. There are anarchists out there who may not follow that mainstream idea of what we believe anarchists are. So even with that, I mean, it's unfair to have a covering of all of them and say this is what they're doing and that's why they're out there.
We're talking about grievance and power and protest today on May Day in Seattle, a day in Baltimore with murder and manslaughter charges capping a week of protests, sometimes peaceful and sometimes not. Talking about it with Eli Sanders, Tanya Mosley, Chris Vance. This morning, Mayor Ed Murray of Seattle said, "I've never seen destruction get us anywhere." We're hoping it's a peaceful day of protest, at least I am, in Seattle today. Facing trial this weekend for protesting, Seattle City Council member Kshama Sawant, who also, by the way, accused a fellow council member of being basically a corporate tool who provided over a cesspool of corruption. Should Kshama Sawant apologize for not being Seattle nice? We take that up in a moment on the Week in Review. On KUOW's Week in Review, we spent the last 10 or 15 minutes talking about who has the right to protest how, and we're still talking about it when the microphones are off. So we're going to, later this hour, we're going to welcome Eric Liu to the program of Citizens United, former policy advisor to President Clinton. He's been thinking and writing about what's going on there. So I'm going to give you vent and continue to talk about this issue because I feel the passion and I appreciate the directness on this.
Well, let me just say, there's nothing more American than to protest. There is nothing more American than to dissent, to petition your government, to air your grievances. I'm all for that. But the minute you choose to hurt your fellow citizen who is innocent, the Korean store owner or the police officer who wasn't involved in any sort of activity, you know, they put over 100 cops in the hospital during those protests. The minute you start hurting people and smashing property, you lose all credibility. You cease to become a protester and you become simply a criminal. And you should be treated as a criminal, period. And
guys, I'm going to give Chris Vance the last word only for now because he's outnumbered and because we are going to pick this topic back up later this hour.
Although we should say on the air that off the air he doesn't feel outnumbered. He feels like he represents 98% of America.
Right, he said 98%.
I would say at least 90 and 100% of Americans would agree with what I'm saying.
So he's not feeling too beat up.
Not at all. You cannot tolerate people breaking the law in our major American cities. No American would stand up and defend that.
Okay. Well, I don't think Tanya and I are encouraging people to break the law. We're saying something that's a little more complicated.
But the question is it ever justified? And the answer is unequivocally, without question, period, no.
And you would not have the United States of America if people always and everywhere believed that.
In that case, you had a militia formed properly by actually the local governments in the 13 colonies.
Okay, you know what?
It was a war.
I'm going to follow the rules, and we get to the next topic because I have a lot to say about this, but I want us to get back to it.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you, all of you, for the discussion. On KUOW's Week in Review, City Council member Kshama Sawant owes an apology. So said the Seattle Times this week. When the City Council was debating who to appoint as a new member, Sawant had strong words about one candidate for the job.
We do not need another loyal representative of Seattle's elite political establishment. It would be scandalous, for example, if any council member today voted John Okamoto, who presided over the Port of Seattle, which was a cesspool of corruption when he was the chief administrative officer.
Well, the City Council did choose John Okamoto, and some of Sawant's fellow council members called her comments untrue, exploitative, mean, odious. Quote, it's unfortunate that she has to stoop so low. Does Kshama Sawant owe her new colleague and her city an apology, Chris Vance?
Oh, absolutely. And this has nothing to do with Seattle Nice. I spent two terms in the legislature and two terms in the King County Council. When you choose to become a member of a parliamentary body, you choose to live by the rules. And the rules under Robert's Rules of Order and all the processes in a parliamentary body are intended to bring people together and produce comity with not a G-E-D-Y, C-O-M-I-T-Y. You are forbidden from impugning the motives of your fellow members. I'm surprised she wasn't gaveled down.
Well, how did she impugn his motives? She said it was scandalous to vote for someone who presided over a cesspool of corruption. I'll give you that. But how did she impugn his motives?
There's also under the rules the idea that you're using words that are not parliamentary. She has to decide if she wants to be a protest leader or a legislator. You can't be both. And if you're going to serve on a lawmaking parliamentary body, you have to be civil.
Is that tactical or ethical?
I mean, ethical. It's ethical. It's what's required by the rules, and it comes from 500 years of evolution of how any sort of lawmaking body functions.
Okay, Tanya, you actually thought the Seattle Times call for her to apologize was a joke.
I thought it was a joke. I thought it was a joke because, yes, it was rude. Yes, it wasn't what we usually see in Seattle politics. But for her to sit down and have to apologize to him, I think that's ridiculous. I think overall she was speaking to her core and to her audience. And the Seattle Times, in that editorial, they talked about how they went back and did some research on his past and what they found that he was at the helm when there were major issues happening.
Yeah. The auditor's office.
Absolutely. Now, whether
not necessarily indicting him in all of those instances.
Right. And whether or not he was a part of that. But at the same time, that is her opinion. That's her thought. And I think that we see in other parts of the country that this is how politics works. I mean, what I find interesting is that because she said that, the Seattle Times went back and took a look at his record. I think that now we actually know more about him. We actually know more about his history in politics. And so really what it did is it gave us an overall view of what's happening there. Many people who do not follow the city council, I think that I don't see this as something that she should apologize for. And I actually thought that article was written. It felt very whiny. Felt very nasally. Like I imagine the people who are sitting down, they just sounded so pouty about it. I mean, no, I don't think she owes him an apology.
Eli?
Let's talk for a second about the factual basis of what she said. Maybe she turned the dial up to 11 when it should have been 7 in terms of cesspool. I don't know. But if you look at the port, the history of the port, which Heidi Groover, our City Hall reporter at The Stranger, did as all of this was churning, there have been multiple complaints over many years about corruption at the port. In 2003, in 2008, string of scandals. The Seattle Times would acknowledge that because they reported on it. And then in 2007, there's a Port Commission report. You can find it actually uploaded on the Seattle Times website that says that Okamoto's position, chief administrative officer, was called out specifically as one part of port leadership that provided a, quote, lack of adequate oversight by allowing the port police to investigate themselves over racist and sexually explicit emails. So he was part of the leadership. He wasn't called out by name in the report, but his position was, which is effectively calling him out, as not providing good oversight during an investigation of improper behavior by the port police. So she's not inventing the idea of problems at the port, nor is she fabricating the idea that Okamoto is connected to at least one problem. Whether she exaggerated or used, you know, language that was too strong, you could make that case maybe, but she's trying to say you're drawing this guy out of a culture that worries me.
So neither you, Tanya, or Eli, you're not calling John Okamoto's appointment to the council scandalous or calling the Port of Seattle a cesspool of corruption, but Chris Vance, isn't it fair for someone who feels that way to... I mean, in politics, we use metaphors. We use rallying language. Why is that out of bounds given all of the facts that you just heard?
Two things. First, as I understand it, she made those remarks in session, sitting in her chair as a member of the Seattle City Council. There's a long tradition that when you're in session, there's language you just don't use. Otherwise, every meeting turns into a brawl.
Well, okay, so it turns into a brawl. Let's get specific about how you think this her language hurts the people of Seattle. That's what, in the end, that's what we're talking about,
because,
right?
Because, again, and this is, I'm certain, in the rules that Seattle City Council operates under, if you begin attacking each other personally rather than debating the issues, every meeting just turns into a dysfunctional brawl and you don't get any of the policy done. Now, if she had made these remarks out of doors, as they say in the British Parliament, not in the chamber, it would have been better. But still, there's just this sense that elected officials debate the issues and don't attack each other personally. Now, it happens. This is an extreme case. But when it does, you cheapen our politics, you make it harder to reach compromise and get the job done.
Chris Vance is an experienced chair of the state Republican Party.
I've spent my whole life in legislative bodies.
A legislator, and you were just agreeing sort of off microphone, Eli, about how obnoxious things have gotten in Olympia, and part of that is venom, right? It's not just policy differences. So can you admit that it's not, or do you agree that it's not good in the end for the residents of a city to have their legislators turning it up to 11.
I just want to say, though, I think that we here in Seattle, we're smart people. We understand. I mean, we see this happen and we can make our own informed decisions. Yes, I think it was rude. Yes, I think that it may have been out of bounds. But ultimately, I don't think she owes him an apology. I think that is my thing. And I think that people will answer to that by when they vote, whether or not they will vote her in the next time.
Last word, Eli.
Here's my perspective on Olympia, actually, is that there's not enough honest venting of people's feelings and motives. There are intractable positions that just stall progress. And that's the problem in Olympia. I would actually like to see more honesty there.
Okay.
The city council, I think the problem is too much nicey-nice, too much, quiet disagreement that is not allowed to come out in public. And then the public doesn't learn anything about the process. Things are already cooked before the vote is ever taken. And so just from a position of wanting to see more honest exchange on the city council or a little bit more back and forth, I don't want her to apologize because I don't want the kind of in-your-faceness that she was moving toward forbidden. I don't, at the same time, you know, I can see why you would criticize her for the specific language, but I don't want people to feel like they can't get in each other's face on the city council.
Okay. Don't be intransigent, but be direct. Somewhere in there, maybe there's some agreement.
Kind of like we have going on right here on the show today.
The bright line in any legislative body is thou shalt not impugn anyone else's motives and make it personal. You're supposed to debate the policy. You can debate the policy. You can use very strong language. I used very strong language attacking, tax-raising liberals in Olympia, but never attack anyone personally by name.
Okay. Whether it was a personal attack, we're circling around. But thank you for the civil and productive discussion. And we're going to come right back, and maybe somebody's going to impugn Channel 9. We'll see. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review with Tanya Mosley, Chris Vance, and Eli Sanders, recapping the top stories of the week and trying to understand them a little more deeply. Who cares about public television? At Seattle's KCTS, Channel 9 local programming has been shrinking for decades. This week, Channel 9 laid off 11 production staffers, canceled its long-form local programming, and said it will focus on shorter digital content. Over the years, one of the station's best-known local personalities has been Barry Mitzman. 18 years at KCTS, he hosted Seattle Week in Review and Friday. He's now a professor of strategic communications at Seattle University. Barry, welcome.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to talk to you again. The president of KCTS said he's positioning Channel 9 for longevity, but you say they should just pull the plug and get out of the local broadcast business. Why?
Well, I wonder about that, yes. You know, there are a lot of good people at KCTS, including some of the people who were let go just recently, and there's still some good people there, and it bothers me a lot in terms of honest venting. You were calling for some honest venting. It bothers me a lot that so many opportunities to provide a greater public service have been squandered over the years at KCTS, and I do think at some point somebody has to ask the obvious question. This digital-first strategy, where they're going to create video, short videos for the Internet, seems to be founded on the idea that what the world needs now is more Internet video.
Well, I mean, pretty soon everything is Internet, right? I mean, the distinction is going away. And let me just add a little detail to that, Barry Mitzman. KCTS says it will host topical websites focused on science and technology, the environment, arts and culture to attract a younger online audience, and it will teach viewers to tell their own stories a la public radio's successful StoryCorps project. How do you know that would fail?
Oh, you don't know that it will fail, but what are the odds? There are so many. There are virtually an infinite number of producers of online video right now, and every other teenager in his bedroom is creating video for the Internet these days. And granted, it's nothing comparable to what KCTS aspires to produce, but what is the likelihood that KCTS will be able to draw a significant audience to video on the Internet when apparently they have not been very able to attract much of an audience to local video when they have a broadcast tower and cable access? The primary reason why, in close, their primary a local current affairs program hosted by your KOW colleague, Deborah Wang, mm-hmm. The stated reason why they wanted to get rid of that or are getting rid of that is that it didn't draw enough of an audience. What's the likelihood when they bury it on the Internet that it will attract an audience there?
I want to open this up to our panel, but one more question for you, Barry Mitzman. Are you being literal when you say they should just pull the plug at being a local TV broadcaster?
Well, look, Channel 9 has an $18 million a year budget. About half of that goes for actual program services. The other half goes for administration and fundraising. KBTC in Tacoma, the public television station in Tacoma, offers essentially the same program service, consisting primarily of PBS programming, and they do it for $5 million a year. So why not consolidate these efforts? Why do we need a separate station to retransmit PBS content, if that's basically all KCTS is going to do?
Anyone here, stay on the line, Barry. Former KCTS host Barry Mitzman saying Channel 9 ought to, at least as a standalone Seattle public TV station, just pull its plug and consolidate. Anybody disagree? By the way, we need to make a disclosure here has anybody here not worked at KCTS? Because I have, and Eli has.
No, I have not.
Oh, have not. Sorry.
I've been on one show once, but that's it.
I received money from them in the past.
Full disclosure, I've produced several pieces for In Close, uh-huh. and I was just producing a piece when this announcement was made. I guess to sort of sideways answer your question, I think it's as a broadcast journalist, we are constantly looking for ways, and I personally, as an independent journalist, are constantly looking at ways that I can produce quality content for broadcast. And when I say quality, I mean in close provided that opportunity to provide in-depth analysis of important stories in our region. Now, on the internet, it's just much more difficult to do that because you have 8 or 9 minutes on in close, and there is no way that an 8 or 9 minute video is going to work online. So that means you have to cut it to 2 minutes or 90 seconds. 90 seconds is the average amount of time someone will spend watching a video online.
We could never get the same people who would want to watch your work on Channel 9. You could never get them to watch it online.
There is a possibility, but I want to tell you about something really quickly. So I contribute regularly to Al Jazeera America, and I do longer form pieces for America Tonight, and those pieces average about 10 minutes. And what I find is I talk to a lot of college students throughout our state. And when I go to these journalism classes, the first thing that young people want to know about is Al Jazeera America. And I find that really interesting because that speaks to what we have traditionally heard about younger audiences, that they don't want to know about, they don't have an interest in in-depth news. They don't have an interest in longer form journalism. That is not true. They are informed citizens and they want to know. But I think we're very confused now on how to reach them. That's the issue. We think the internet might be the place. We're not sure if we can get them to television. And so I think everyone's dumbfounded at this time. But to say that we cannot capture that audience, I don't think it's true. I think we just haven't figured out how.
What should KCTS do?
Well, far be it for me to give them advice. It's just, it's sad.
You've been on the TV station quite a bit.
Not too many years ago, I was a regular guest every Sunday morning on both Robert Mack's public affairs program on King 5 and Enrique Cerna's program on Channel 9. Maybe they died because of me. I don't know. But those programs are both gone now. Local television is completely abandoning the field in terms of covering public affairs and politics. And I understand that because it doesn't make a profit for them. And the good thing is the internet is full of great websites that have rich, deep content on policy and politics. If you want to go find it, it's all there. That's great. But public television should be covering public policy. So I think it's terrible the direction KCTS is going. They're not in the business to make a profit, and they should be covering Washington State and Seattle and King County politics. There's no excuse for them not to.
Eli Sanders.
You were talking about access to democracy earlier, and I agree with you on this specific point that the rate at which TV broadcasters in Seattle are abandoning the mission to provide informative local news so that people can actually have an informed opinion about the democratic process in this city, it's appalling.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, well, and I also want to say I hate seeing journalists lose their jobs. This reminds me of the PI disappearing. Mm-hmm. And so I hate that. But the business is undergoing this incredibly wrenching change. And as Tanya's saying, no one's quite figured it out. Personally, I don't own a television. I never watch local PBS. That tells me that there's, even though I've been on one show once, and I still don't watch it, like there's nothing there that's pulling me into local PBS broadcasting. And honestly, if I came across a video online that was telling me something urgent from our local PBS broadcaster, I would watch it. And I look at John Oliver and what he's doing with his show and the very long online videos that people share around like crazy. And I think it's not easy, but if they could figure out a way to make informative public interest broadcast journalism work online, I would love that and I would watch it.
Barry Mitzman, former KCTS host, and I'll give you the last word, if any.
I just want to make the case that, yes, things are difficult out there and the world is changing, but don't let KCTS off the hook, because there are communities across the country where public broadcasters are making a difference. In Minneapolis, KTCA continues a strong commitment to local public affairs and current affairs programming, and those programs are watched. They make news because station has had a long-term commitment to local production and local public service, something that has been missing at KCTS for decades. And the reason why you don't watch KCTS is because that commitment has rarely, if ever, been sustained for any length of time. In Close was on for 7 months. 60 Minutes took 3 years to begin to gain an audience on CBS. in close, they gave 7 months, and it's gone.
Barry Mitzman, gone from KCTS, now professor of strategic communications at Seattle U. Thank you for joining us, Barry.
Thank you.
And we are going to talk with the CEO of KCTS, the president, Rob Dunlop, next week here on KUOW's Midday News Magazine, The Record. This is The Week in Review. We'll be right back. With Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor at The Stranger, Eli Sanders, Seattle journalist Tanya Mosley, contributor to Al Jazeera America, sometimes to KUOW, too, and Chris Vance, public affairs consultant, former chair of the Washington State Republicans. I'm Bill Radke, and this is The Week in Review. May Day in Seattle. Besides rallies for worker and immigrant rights, there is a Black Lives Matter event at Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Park. This morning's news that prosecutors are filing homicide charges, murder and manslaughter charges, against the police officers involved in that Baltimore killing may calm the situation in Seattle. But to Seattle police, at last word, were on guard for even the possibility of civil disobedience after this week's burning and looting in Baltimore. We are getting more aware of the anger in this country over issues of race, power, money, opportunity. And if we're going to solve these issues, we need to know who to blame. Our next guest blames you and himself. Eric Liu is deputy domestic policy advisor for President Bill Clinton, and he's the founder of Citizen University in Seattle. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You say we all burned Baltimore this week. What do you mean?
Well, I said that in a column that I wrote for CNN, and as the sentence says, we all burned it. We all own a piece of what brought us to this week's disturbances. We all own the structural inequities, the neglect of those inequities, the brutalization of people of color, particularly African-American men. We all own a piece of that, either by direct engagement or by benign or malign neglect. And to be able to, you know, to want to say that that's a problem over there that you can carve off and say, man, they're messed up over in Baltimore, is not only naive, it's dangerous, because all of us, part of what I was arguing in this piece was there's two ways in which we have to really rethink the meaning of the word we, both in talking about the problem and in talking about the solution.
Usually when Americans say we did something, it's something wonderful.
Yeah, look, I'm as a son of immigrants, I do this a lot. I love to claim the civic we. We won the Second World War. We put a man on the moon. You know, we invented jazz. You know, we do awesome things as American. But you can't claim that side without also claiming the liabilities. We enslaved Africans. We beheaded Native tribes. We created structural, by law and by code, structures of racism and inequity whose effects live with us still today. And so owning the we side of the problem brings us to the we side of the solution, because this can't just be about, you know, oh, I wish African Americans would get their own house in order. Or I wish liberals would just fix their own policies that brought us here. Oh, I wish conservatives would just do it. We all have to figure out how we can contribute to solving problems like Baltimore. Or look, again, we here in Seattle, let's not kid ourselves. The same dynamics, perhaps not at the same scale or intensity, but the same dynamics exist right here in our community.
Chris Vance, do you accept that we're all to blame?
Yes, in a broad sense, yes. And the statistic that I keep going back to and I talk about, and it's always in my head, is the fact that real wages for men who only have a high school diploma have dropped 40% since 1970. The economy has changed fundamentally and not in a good way. The income gap is real. The opportunity gap is real. I read something the other day that referred to the college-educated elite, which just kind of is jarring. The low-skill, high-wage, unionized jobs that provided so much of a safety net and a foundation for so many American families don't exist anymore. And that has led to so much else going on in places like Baltimore that it ends up in this result. We as a country need to be much more serious about addressing those core problems that are causing this. So in a broad sense, I agree.
Who has a suggestion for how America gets serious about addressing its problems? What can we do? We can talk a lot here. What can we do?
I'd like to say, I mean, on a fundamental level, we first have to listen and accept it. I mean, as a minority and also as someone who speaks often about issues of race and class and culture, I often have people who tell me one of two things. And I'm talking about people who are part of the majority. So white people, they tell me one, they never, oh, I had no idea. And or number two, I don't accept what you are saying. And so when it comes to that, I think that that is amazing to me. There's this amazing blind spot when it comes to issues of race, class, and culture and the disparities there. And so in many ways, there's this Marvin Gaye song, makes me want to holler, throw up both my hands. I mean, that's what the rioters are basically doing. I mean, it makes me want to holler when people tell me, I don't accept what you are saying. I don't accept your reality and the reality of your people because it is not my reality.
Eric, is that shared? Let's for a moment talk about liberals and conservatives because it is so convenient. are liberals guilty of just as guilty of not listening?
Let me flip the frame from blame to solutions here. Listening to Chris, one thing that's really important to recognize is for all the problems we have right now and all the very manifest divisions that exist between right and left. We are in an interesting moment right now where Mike Lee, a Tea Party senator, Republican senator from Utah, and Hillary Clinton, where Cory Booker, a Democrat from New Jersey, and Rand Paul, a Republican, you know, are agreeing that we've got to reform our prison industrial complex. We've got to change our criminal justice system. Now, their particular reforms, they may not agree on every dot and jot, but the fact that they are now agreeing, each for their own different principled reasons, right? Limited government conservatives and libertarians want to roll back the size of the state. Social justice liberals want to have social justice for people of color. But there is a convergence right now where people are agreeing the system that has got us here, the system that routinely incarcerates people, that routinely takes people out of this school-to-prison pipeline in a way that we've kind of become mindless about, that system can't stand anymore. And I think that's actually a little bit of a cause for optimism right now.
Eli, are you as optimistic?
I think that something that Eric was saying struck me, which is that look at the moment that we're in right now, just in a broader perspective. And I didn't go exactly to where he was, but I went to the fact that we live, even in some of the hardest parts of America, we live a relatively comfortable life compared to the rest of the world. And so there, we have made, all in all, a certain amount of progress. There is so much wrong with this country, though, and so much to be done. And if you're asking me for one solution, I don't have it. I think what Eric Liu is saying is one piece of it. I think restructuring our tax policy is another piece of it. I think being really serious about reforming our police departments, we've seen this in Seattle as well, is another piece of it. I think listening, as Tanya is saying, is yet another piece of it. It's going to be a long project. It was a long time getting to this point.
One of the things that, you know, I would say to emphasize what Tanya was describing about listening, that listening has to happen not only across lines of race, but also across lines of ideology, right? I'm a good progressive. I was very active in the $15 minimum wage fight. I believe that there are things that government can and should be doing to close the opportunity gap. At the same time, I don't pretend that progressives, that my fellow Democrats or liberals, have all the answers, just as I wouldn't assume that conservatives have all the fault or all the blame for how we got here. And our ability and our willingness to actually listen across those lines, to me, the only test is, are you in earnest trying to solve the problem? If all you're doing is talking points, if all you're doing is trying to score some political points, not interesting, either on left or right. But if you actually have an idea that is about a government solution or an idea that's perhaps a faith-based solution, or you got an idea that is about the individual or an idea that is about large communities, bring it to the table. This is a time where we've got to do that in an open-minded way.
Although you heard earlier in the show that even Chris and Tanya and I don't agree on what the problem is, right? We all look at Baltimore and we see a different problem, or some of us see different problems. And how do you even get to a solution if you don't share a sense of the problem?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I think we all agree on the problem. I just don't think that there's ever a justification for smashing people's windows. But
what's the problem in your sense?
Okay. The problem is what we're talking about is a lack of any sort of opportunity that communicates to people that they're invested in their community and their society. They see no hope for the future. So why not burn it down? You mentioned taxes, and I think that's a perfect example. Most everyone accepts that our tax structure is unfair and anti-growth. And there are things we could do to, for instance, lowering taxes for everyone while getting rid of a lot of these exemptions and tax expenditures and changing our corporate tax structure, which encourages jobs to go overseas. And a lot of people agree with that. President Obama appointed a commission, the Simpson-Bowles Commission. They came up with a great proposal on this, a bipartisan, moderate. It can't pass because, unfortunately, the partisan gridlock right now in D.C. is the worst it's ever been, and it's getting nothing but worse.
We're going to drill arctically in a moment, but I want to give Eric Liu the last word, our guest.
Well, you know, the thing that I would say is that it is a both and. It is both that there is a lack of economic opportunity and that there is both a legacy and a living legacy of racial injustice and racial bias. And to pretend that it's one or the other only is not going to get us to where we got to go.
Eric, the way you put it in your CNN piece, that they basically magnify each other.
That's right.
Eric Liu of Citizen University, building a stronger culture of citizenship, formerly with the Clinton administration. It's good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
On KUOW's Week in Review, as I say, Shell, what to do about Shell when we return on KUOW. Former Republican Washington State Party Chair Chris Vance, journalists Tanya Mosley and Eli Sanders. I'm Bill Radke with the Week in Review. And this past weekend, there was a protest at Myrtle Edwards Park from people who don't want Seattle to host Shell Oil's Arctic oil drilling fleet. Well, a drilling rig is on the way, headed here to the Port of Seattle. This month, we will see much bigger demonstrations, civil disobedience, a blockade. What will this accomplish, Chris Vance?
I don't know. Again, they certainly have every right to protest, but it just it seems so counterintuitive and so out of step with the reality of what's happening in the world out there. New techniques for extracting oil and gas have turned the United States into the world's largest energy producer again, created tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of new jobs, which we need in this country, lowered gas prices, which President Obama hails and tries to take credit for. So to protest against, you know, this sort of thing just seems so out of step with what's happening in the real world out there. We'd all love a world someday where cars ran on something else. But between now and then, cheap energy is good for America and good for everyone.
Eli, energy independence, low gas prices, jobs.
To ignore the environmental effects of drilling and of the car-centered economy ignores what's going on in the world out there. Global warming is real, and there's a study out just recently this year in the journal Nature that says if we don't avoid this 2% rise in temperature that is going to occur, we are going to pass a tipping point that will be basically catastrophic for life on Earth. And to avoid reaching that 2% rise, we have to leave some of our oil resources in the ground, specifically the oil in the Arctic.
So, Chris, aren't you talking about short-term gains? And Eli is talking about when do you solve the bigger problems we have?
No, and I believe global warming is real. I think ocean acidification, if nothing else, proves that. The issue is there's going to be drilling in the Arctic. It's just this symbolic protest of we don't want it here because we're Seattle and we're so eco-friendly. It's just theater. It has nothing to do with actual policy.
And Tanya, is it just theater and is that a bad thing?
I don't think so. What was interesting about the protest on Sunday is that there was a large contingent of young people, people under the age of 28, a large contingent of women. They spoke to how some minority communities are affected by this. We take a look at Nigeria, for instance. We take a look at Ecuador and some of the things that are happening there with drilling and some of the environmental impacts there. And so I don't think that it's theater. I think that people truly care whether or not they can actually make an impact and do something. Well, it brings awareness. That's one thing. It brings awareness of what is imminent to happen in Alaska. That's another thing. And so, but we can't ignore the ramifications to the environment.
We have one of the most environmentally active governors in America. Why isn't Jay Inslee opposing this hosting of the Shell Arctic drilling fleet?
That's a very good question. And we looked into that in this week's Stranger. Sydney Brownstone has a story in which she got some emails from the governor's staff through a public records request that saw them debating just exactly how firm he should be on this. He has kind of tried to bridge the divide and said people have legitimate concerns about the process at the port that led to this, which was not very transparent. And talk about concerns about the port, by the way. We were talking about that earlier. Mm-hmm. And at the same time...
That wasn't over the line, right, Chris?
That was not over the line.
It was moderated.
Robert's rules of order,
and you're not
gavel me out.
Nobody here is an elected official.
And at the same time, the governor's office, my interpretation, saying, well, we don't want to be on the wrong side of what Chris Vance is saying, that the port is an economic engine, that there maybe is some good financial gain from this. I just want to respond to something Chris said. Arctic drilling, at least as it involves companies involved in the U.S., is not a fait accompli. It's not going to happen anyway. Shell is the only company currently with a U.S. lease to drill in the Arctic this summer. So there's only one company that's doing this, and they are docking their ships in this month in Seattle to repair them to go up to the Arctic. If protesters succeed in hemming them in Puget Sound, which is part of the strategy, then no, there won't be drilling in that part of the Arctic.
Well, I can't imagine they couldn't get the ability to dock their ships in Vancouver or San Francisco or somewhere else. It's the same thing. Look, I believe global warming is real. I think I chastise Republicans who don't believe that. But the answer is to control pollution the same way we always have with technology. We need to get to things like carbon capture and cleaner cars. But there's going to be drilling in the Arctic. It's inevitable.
Chris Vance, former chair of the state Republican Party, and Tanya Mosley, Seattle-based journalist, contributor to Al Jazeera America, and to others. I've heard you on KUOW. I've heard you on Cairo. Anything else you want to plug on the way out?
I'm a Knight Fellow.
A Knight Fellow, that's
Knight
right.
Fellow.
Stanford, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Eli Sanders, I think, won a prize from somebody.
Somewhere. Sometime.
Pulitzer man from The Stranger. Thank you, all of you, for joining us. This producer of the show is Jason Pagano, and we're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Tweet us at KUOW, and go to KUOW.org and download a podcast of this here program. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.